From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We have some cells from the Caucasus population, Adigi from the Caucasus Mountains, from a collaboration with individuals in Russia. Here we have some cells of Siberians, and here we have some cells of a Native American population.
The Gene Hunters. Today, a look at the Human Genome Diversity Project. Whose blood? Who benefits?
It's even worse than kind of standard colonialism and exploitation because we are taking the one thing that we value, and after we take that, we have no real interest in whether they live or die.
And five Nobel Peace Prize winners gather to call for a halt to weapon sales to dictators. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A judge has granted a new trial for Elmer Geronimo Pratt, capping a 25-year legal battle by lawyers who said his murder conviction was political retribution against the Black Panthers. Orange County Superior Court Judge Everett Dickey ruled that Pratt's 1972 conviction was heavily influenced by the testimony of an informant whose infiltration of the Black Panther Party was unknown at the time of Pratt's trial. He added that the prosecution wrongly suppressed information about the informant, Julius Butler, which could have swayed jurors in a different direction. Pratt was convicted of the December 1968 slaying of Santa Monica school teacher Carolyn Olson. He was sentenced to 25 years to life in prison and has been turned down for parole 16 times. Pratt maintained from the beginning he was not in Los Angeles when the killing occurred, but was in Oakland at Black Panther Party headquarters. Dickey ordered Pratt released from state prison and placed in the custody of the Los Angeles County Sheriff for a new trial or, quote, other appropriate disposition. The Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office, which had opposed a retrial, issued a brief statement saying no decision had been made on whether to appeal. In a 13-page decision, Dickey concluded that, quote, the evidence which was withheld about Julius Butler and his activities could have put the whole case in a different light, and failure to timely disclose it undermines confidence in the verdict. The decision came after a hearing that had been seen as the end of the legal line for Pratt. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Today on Democracy Now! We're going to take an extended look at some worrying trends in the brave new world of biotechnology and biogenetics. One of the areas we'll examine is the phenomenon of bioprospecting, or how giant multinational corporations and large governmental research organizations are scouring the earth for biological and genetic material, including human material, to patent and sell. In a minute, we'll look at the Human Genome Diversity Project, which is a project that includes scientists going around the earth looking for the blood of indigenous people. But first, we'll hear from internationally renowned ecologist, activist, and physicist Vandana Shiva about the increasing corporate control of seeds and the genetic material of the food we eat. Vandana Shiva is the director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy based in India, and she's just published a new book called Biopiracy, the Plunder of Nature and Knowledge. She spoke last month at a biogenetics teach-in that was put on by the Learning Alliance in New York City.
Basically, in my view, the issue of patents on life, of genetic engineering, and the control over agriculture and healthcare is really a choice between totalitarianism and democracy. The fact that the totalitarianism is being institutionalized through free trade very often makes people confused that maybe there is some freedom involved. But as far as people are concerned, consumers have no right to know. Labeling is being treated as illegitimate, a demand that needn't be met. Farmers have no right to save seed. Farmers have no right to know either. They're supposed to just blindly follow the prescription and sign over their fate. The Monsanto agreement, I've called it a high-tech slavery agreement, because the farmers get the seed, and for 3 years after that, Monsanto has a right to come and inspect your premises without your permission, 3 years after the planting. You don't have a right to use what you want to as input. Monsanto decides that only Monsanto chemicals will be used with that seed. And if for some reason you cannot fulfill your obligations under the contract, the children of the farmer have to are bound by the contract, which they never agreed to and never signed. And that kind of expansion of power is being actually facilitated. I've just two things come to my mind. When they drafted the GATT treaty, it was the Monsanto representative, James Enyart, who actually said, "We have done something unprecedented in GATT. We were the architects of this treaty. We were the patient, the physician, and the diagnostician all in one. We defined the problem. We got the solution." And more recently, with this amazing buy-up where Monsanto now owns Calgene, or Flavor Saver, has bought up Agrocetus, which had the broad species patents on cotton and soybean, has bought up Asgrow, has bought up Decarb, has recently bought up a seed company called Holden for 23 times its market worth at $1 billion. And the same journal, which is not pro-people at all, it's absolutely a sales pitch for biotechnology, was the first place where I found out about the Neem patents, where they actually said the first biopesticide facility in the world to be built by Grace. You know, and here I have seen biopesticide facilities in every home in India, every village in India. That's how I started to follow the Neem patents. Same journal actually says for the first time, something strange is going on. If a company is able to pay 23 times the value of a seed company, they are not involved in a market transaction. They are basically trying to get total control. And a few companies will control the entire food system from the seed all the way to the table. Focusing on monopolies is one part of where we have to go. A no to patents on life has to be linked both to the resistance to monopolies and totalitarianism, but also to the ethical dimension. I basically feel that they're jumping too much, too fast. It usually takes a century or two to change a worldview. And they're believing that worldviews can be changed on Wall Street time. That just because their stocks are jumping or falling, that people's minds are switching accordingly. I think it's our decentralization that is our strength. It is our diversity that is our strength. And one of the things we've started to do in India, and I have some copies of this new report called The Enclosure and Recovery of the Commons, because I really feel that's what it is about. Life is a commons. You cannot reproduce agricultural crops as total private property. That's the end. You plant out the same seed 3 years in a row. That's the end of your seed. There's a beautiful ceremony that takes place at the beginning of every agricultural season in India, where tribals bring in their seed, and a village might have as much as 100 rice varieties. They bring in their seed, mix it together, take back samples, put that into their field, and it is a way of remembering two things. One, that the seed is a commons. Two, that unless you have exchange networks with your neighbors and other villages, the quality of your seed, your viability of your seed, is going to get destroyed. Exchange and commons and sharing is the basis of the reproduction of life. It is not pollution and contamination, as Richard Dawkins and the selfish gene thinks. It is the only ground for flourishing. And the same goes for knowledge. If they think they can run universities by making it illegal for graduate students to talk to each other, they think they can make it run universities by making the obligations of professors to the companies who have given them a tiny project and not to the public system that is giving them their salary, you can be absolutely sure brains are going to go totally defunct in universities, and it's only on the streets we will have thinking people. Well, as part of what we've done in India, we started a movement for common rights, for recovery of the commons. And in the area of intellectual property rights, we're basically saying, no, we've had tremendous innovation. It's been collective innovation. We're going to defend it as a collective innovation. We're not going to treat it as private property. We're not going to run in competition with each other and say, no, I should get the $5,000 compensation, or so-and-so should get the $10,000 compensation. These are areas where corporations have to be told, hands off. Life, hands off. Indigenous knowledge, hands off. Biodiversity, hands off. Our food systems, hands off. And The movement is growing wonderfully. You know, suddenly I'll get an invitation from a village where they say, we're declaring our resources our common property. And come in for the declaration ceremony. That, the combination of two things, I believe, by the turn of the millennium, we can actually shape a new world. And the combination is knowing clearly what you want to say no to. And I think we want to say no to patents on life. And we want to say no to genetically engineered foods. We want to say no to genetic engineering of animals and human beings. We don't need genetic engineering, even of crops. And we have to know what we have to say yes to. And thank goodness, they might make better Boeings, but we can grow better food and process better food. Thank you.
And that was Vandana Shiva, physicist, ecologist, and activist, director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy, based in India. In 1993, she won the Right Livelihood Award, also known as the Alternative Nobel Peace Prize. But it's not only the patenting or the privatization of the agricultural knowledge and wealth of the world that's happening, but also the taking of human material. As we said earlier, the Human Genome Diversity Project, scientists and corporations scouring the earth for the blood of indigenous people. We're going to take a look at that. For what purpose? Who benefits? Who owns the blood? A recent British documentary looks at this issue. It's called The Gene Hunters, and right now we play an excerpt.
An expedition into the rainforests of northern Colombia. But these explorers are not in search of rare butterflies. They're here to collect blood. They are geneticists. The purpose of their expedition? To collect the DNA of endangered species, of humans. In laboratories across the world, the cells of indigenous peoples are being immortalized, multiplying indefinitely to provide a biological bank for genetic research. For 10 years now, scientists from a genetics institute in Bogota have been traveling into the least accessible parts of Colombia. They're building up a biological bank of blood cells taken from isolated tribes who are genetically unique. Soon they may be sharing these samples with scientists worldwide as part of an international program, the Human Genome Diversity Project, which wants to collect and store the DNA from 700 tribes in danger of extinction. But they face unexpected opposition.
La usurpación que ha habido en los territorios indígenas, en el despojo de nuestras tierras, en el despojo de la cultura.
This is Leonora Zalabata. She is an Arhuaca Indian. She says our land, our culture, our subsoil, our ideology, our tradition have been exploited. And she says, is this another form? She says, only now they are using us as raw material. Something we didn't even know we had.
Como materia prima, como algo que nosotros tenemos y que ellos ignoran.
The geneticists see themselves only as pure scientists. Dr. Alberto Gomez specializes in immune systems. His colleague, Ignacio Briseño, is studying for a PhD at Newcastle upon Tyne. He wants samples to take back to his lab in England. Today, they're climbing into the Sierra Nevada of northeast Colombia to visit the Arhuaco people. The Arhuaco number only about 11,000 and rarely intermarry with other tribes. This makes them genetically unique, ideal material for the diversity project. But a history of exploitation and violence has made the Arhuaco suspicious of the white man. A few years ago, the Arhuaco rebelled against the imposition of a foreign language and culture. Missionaries and teachers were expelled from their community. visiting scientists will have to reach an understanding with the tribe if they're to get their blood samples. Unknown to the scientists, strange rumors have preceded their arrival.
Someone from the community told me today that there was a woman that came here, a woman representing the government, and told them that we really didn't want to do the tests, but what we really want is to get pure Arako blood to be able to clone the perfect Arako in our laboratories. And besides that, find a way to destroy all the community by genetic approaches. Genetics, cloning, all these terms are very difficult for these people to understand.
We now turn to Dr. Clarence Annis of the Massachusetts Institute
gained the confidence of the tribe by offering them medical services. They set up their clinic in a disused schoolroom. The service includes a test for diabetes. But in addition to the sample for the diabetic test, another sample is taken for the biological bank. The Indians are told that this is so that tests for other diseases can be made back in the lab. No mention is made of immortalization.
In fact, we don't tell every community at the first point. We don't arrive say, hello, we are immortalizing yourselves, because that's not a proper protocol. The first thing you do is you go there, you arrive, and you are in the silence of the community, and you just wait for something to happen. And then the relationship goes on, and then you get to know people who may be receptive.
Are there any ethical problems with the human genome diversity problem?
This is Dr. Clarence Annis of MIT.
How do you get consent from a tribe that either has never seen the outside world, or the only time it's seen it, it's been shooting at it, right? or trying to take away its habitat in terms of its animals that live around it, its plants that live around it, and the things that it uses to survive? It seems to me that it is unlikely that any so-called vanishing tribe that understood the project, understood that what you want to do is take our DNA before we vanish, before we become extinct because of what the first world is doing to us, or because of what's going on in our country, that you want to take from us the only thing that you value, and so therefore you'll be totally indifferent to whether we survive or not. It seems unlikely that you would consent to that.
Would it be better not to do it the way that they propose doing it, and yet have these ethnic groups disappear and their genetic heritage vanish, and no? I mean,
That's a fair question. It's their DNA, and so you can't just go and take it without their informed consent. And I think that it is virtually impossible at this stage to get the informed consent of indigenous people to this. Number one, I think if they understood the project, they would refuse. And number two, if they don't understand the project, they can't give consent. So it's just total exploitation. It's taking things which can be of no benefit to them.
The average person, even with a half-decent education, wouldn't
this
know, much less
Roy Apodago. He is with the National Congress of the American Indian.
Who doesn't even know what DNA is, much less what they're allowing to happen.
What they are allowing to happen is the immortalization of human blood cells. This is the Yale laboratory of Professor Ken Kidd, a key figure in the diversity project.
Here we have some cells from the Caucasus population, a digi from the Caucasus Mountains, from a collaboration with individuals in Russia. Here we have some cells of Siberians, and here we have some cells of a Native American population. These on this side are not growing very well, but these are growing very well. There's a color indicator in here when they need feeding and more medium, the pH changes.
You know, we have been historically the guinea pigs, the lab rats for a lot of experiments, for a lot of learning and collection of knowledge. And once again, we're being put in that in that perspective. They've not asked whether we want to be the subject of this.
We're taking from them their DNA, which we now consider like gold. It's even worse than kind of standard colonialism and exploitation, because we are taking the one thing that we value, and after we take that, we have no real interest in whether they live or die.
An excerpt of The Gene Hunters, a British documentary. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll talk more about biotechnology and biogenetics in just a minute. Welcome to Democracy Now! For the second segment, I am Amy Goodman. We're going to continue with our extended look at the questions, ethics, and false promises of bioengineering. We now hear from Dr. Jonathan King, a member of the Council for Responsible Genetics and a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He spoke last month at a biogenetics teach-in at the Learning Alliance in New York City.
My name is Jonathan King. I do it, genetic engineering. But I'm also on the board of directors of the Council for Responsible Genetics, which is one of the organizations that has worked together with a secular coalition called the Blue Mountain Coalition to try to move the same campaign through the American public. Anybody here either suffer from diabetes or have anybody in their family who suffers from diabetes? Very common disease in the United States. One of the first kind of victories of the modern pharmaceutical industry was the development of insulin, of course, which does not cure diabetes, but alleviates the symptoms. As Vandana pointed out, the difference between going after the root and the symptoms. The Eli Lilly Corporation grew up and all across the United States in slaughterhouses of people cut out the pancreas of cattle and pigs, and cut out the little group of cells that make the insulin, and chopped it up and sent it to a biochemical plant and extracted insulin. And now the human insulin gene has been cloned, has been spliced into bacteria, and in one plant on Jefferson Avenue in Indianapolis, Indiana, the Eli Lilly Corporation produces in enormous fermenters, just like beer is produced, 1,000-gallon, 40,000-gallon fermenters, enough human insulin to provide for every diabetic in the United States. One of the virtues of the technology is it does allow the production of human insulin at very, very, very low cost. But in part because Eli Lilly, we don't own, even though it's our insulin gene, Eli Lilly owns our insulin gene, right? Because the patent on the insulin gene means you own the insulin gene of every human being on the surface of the earth. Because they own the patent on the insulin gene, they sell it at a very high price, because the patent is a monopoly process. Now, that's one aspect of it, right, that the patenting keeps the price high, and that's true for almost all genetically engineered drugs, and it's one of the reasons why the pharmaceutical and biotechnology industry fights tooth and nail to protect these patenting and intellectual property rights, because it's the mechanism of monopoly and it's the source of the super profits. The moment you disallow patents, then somebody who produces it more efficiently and is willing to sell it more cheaply can compete with you in the market. So the patents are the mechanism of excluding competition. But the other thing about it is, in order for the companies to reap these enormous profits, you have to stay sick, right? So the enormous profits that comes out of selling people insulin depends on diabetes continuing as a disease, right? They have no economic interest in supporting the line of research that would say, what causes diabetes? Insulin doesn't cause it, right? It's damage to a certain group of cells in your pancreas, in many cases, or the cells that receive the insulin. What causes this disease? There's an enormous industry, a diabetes research industry, which all has the character of blaming you in some sense for that you have diabetes. You got it from your mother, you got it from your father, it's what you eat, you don't take care of yourself, you eat too much sugar, this and that. And you cannot find a research project of all these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of research projects that says maybe something is poisoning our pancreas cells. Because diabetes is not inherited. It's familial. You know what else is familial? Black lung disease is familial, because the most likely people to work in mines are people who are the children of mines. Mercury poisoning is familial, because if you're getting mercury in your food, every member of the family. Lead poisoning is familial, because if your children live in a house where they're eating paint off the walls, the Japanese family who in Minamata, who got mercury poisoning because they were eating fish that was polluted with mercury coming out of the Chiso chemical factory, that ran in the families, right? Okay, so familial is not inherited. If your doctor tells you something is familial, remind him that that doesn't mean it's in the genes. It means it runs in the family. Now, much more in the news these days is cancer, breast cancer, right? Why do you have cancer? Because you have cancer genes, oncogenes. Very interesting formulation. Right? Why do women get breast cancer? Because they're women. Right? I mean, that's basically, right? That's basically the image. All right. So let's get the story correct. All human beings have the quote breast cancer genes. They're genes that are important for the formation of the epithelium that forms this part of your body. I mean, in men it's not so active, but we also have chests as well as women. You get breast cancer if the breast cancer genes are damaged, right? In general, cancer is damage to some genes that are needed to control the reproduction of your cells. So lung cancer, the carcinogens in the cigarette smoke, damage the genes in the epithelial cells of the lungs that control their reproduction. How do you keep yourself from getting cancer? You identify what is damaging your genes. Sometimes it's pretty clear. If you're a uranium miner, in Nevada or Utah or in Germany where the original uranium mines are, there's no confusion. You work in the mines, you're exposed to uranium and radiation, you get cancer. Everybody understands it. You're around Hiroshima and Nagasaki, nobody says the increased frequency of leukemia has got people have leukemia genes. No, it's because their genes were exposed to damage. Now, what happens when you're patenting? What happened with the breast cancer genes? Myriad Pharmaceutical in California patented the breast cancer genes, the first ones identified. Now, the ability to make a profit off those patents depends on selling you something, right? In this case, they're selling women a test for $2,400 a test to find out whether the genes in tissue in your breast already has sustained some damage. In fact, if you go back into the original literature on the oncogene and ask in the scientific literature and ask, where did the first oncogene come from? It was a mouse whose skin was smeared with pollutants that come from auto emissions, polyaromatic. I forget the actual particular chemical, but one of those big ring compounds that's in soot, and it's long been known as a carcinogen. And that piece of information disappears rapidly, and then people talk about oncogenes, and it's in your genes, and if you get the oncogene, et cetera. What does it mean that you inherited it from your mother? You know what that means? It means she was exposed to carcinogens, right? The fact that something was inherited doesn't mean it takes it out of the world of the interaction with the real world. It just meant that the previous generations were exposed to this kind of damage. Okay, so the moving of all this information into private property, into corporate property, has a profound effect on the course of research. right? Because young scientists see where the activity is, they see where the action is. It doesn't even occur to them that you could take this information and go out there and ask what causes breast cancer. Now, I'm in a leading biology department in the world, and there are many, many, many laboratories who are studying various kinds of cancer genes, kidney cancer genes, liver cancer genes, never lung cancer genes, right? Lung cancer is a different world, right? If you know there's an external cause, well, then it's not science, that's politics, right? They don't understand what you're talking about when you pose the question, well, let's find out what actually causes the cancer. Oh, you mean people's lifestyle? No, no, the actual thing that damages the genes. Well, that's very messy, that's very complicated. We don't want to do that. So this is happening on the world scale, right? This distortion of the ability to formulate where lies the origin of human diseases. Now, the origin of human disease is very complex, but not for particular diseases. There's no doubt you don't smoke, your chances of not getting lung cancer go way down. You don't work in the chemical industry in New Jersey or the Midwest, in the rubber industry, your chances of bladder cancer go way down, because the major bladder carcinogen in the industrial world is a class of organic compounds, benzidine compounds, that were brought into existence in the modern world as substitutes for natural dyes as a result of World War I and World War II. Okay. Now, I want to close and just sharpen some points that have already been made with great clarity, but I just want to make sure you don't lose them in the many points. Vandana talked about the owning of seeds and plants and Dali. If you think about breeding, animal breeding, there are people and companies who make a living breeding sheep, for example, for finer wool. When they sell those sheep, until recently, some farmer bought those sheep, and then all subsequent sheep belonged to the farmer, right? Not so with the cloned sheep, right? Because they patented the cloning process, every sheep brought into the world through the cloning, that cloning process, right, has to pay, license fees have to be paid to the owner of the patent, right? So the cloning process allows the monopoly control that's being put in place over food plants to be extended to animals. And in the long run, I personally believe that's what it's about. And they might not know right now how they're going to make a fortune off of controlling the world sheep supply, right? But they know, get monopoly control over it, and then when the opportunity comes, we'll be in place. So there's no doubt that that's going on. There's a lot of fog. Well, it's for health, it's for better drugs, et cetera. That's going on, but the fundamental thing is taking the natural world and privatizing it, right? A very profound form of theft, of appropriation at a world scale. Two other things I want to say. If you think about the enormous scope of what we've heard today, there may be a tendency to say, gee, what can 50 people sitting in a room in Lafayette Street in Astor Place do, you know, about this international monopoly? And there's no doubt that that these corporations that used to be national targets have now organized themselves internationally at a very, very sophisticated level. They're getting rid of national barriers. They don't need nations anymore to fully exploit the wealth of the world, right? You can have truly transnational, multinational corporations. But interestingly enough, around these issues, around the ownership of life forms, there's a more highly developed movement internationally than on many other struggles. How often on Lafayette Street do you have somebody who is a world leader, right, and who is speaking to small farmers in India and leading a movement there, here talking to us? The United Auto Workers used to represent 1 million workers, right, never brought over, right, from Mexico, to this day hasn't brought here from Mexico someone who represents Mexican auto workers so the group can work together. So for interesting reasons that I don't fully understand, there's actually more of an international network around these issues than many, many, many other issues we deal with. And also they have this gut impact, right? The food you eat, the very sense of being a human. And I don't think that these are issues that one is going to be powerless toward. Absolutely not. Because of the way they grab human consciousness, you heard from J.D. how the corporations immediately move to hire their own religious ethicists in order to try to circumvent that motion. One of the things that came out of the Blue Mountain process was a petition campaign, No Patents on Life. I'll read it to you. The plants, animals, and microorganisms comprising life on Earth are part of the natural world in which we are all born. Now, this was a secular statement because we knew there was a religious community. The conversion of these species, their molecules or parts, into corporate property through patent monopolies is counter to the interests of the peoples of this country and of the world. No individual, institution, or corporation should be able to claim ownership over species or varieties of living organisms, nor should they be able to hold patents on organs, cells, genes, or proteins, whether naturally occurring, genetically altered, or otherwise modified. As part of the world movement to protect our common living heritage, we call upon the Congress of the United States to enact legislation to exclude living organisms and their component parts in the patent system. By the way, patents, just laws, right? It's not insured, just laws made by Congress. All the Constitution says is Congress shall have the right to enact laws in this area. For 200 years, living organisms were excluded from patent law. Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, wrote the patent laws. He was a plant breeder. He knew all about it. And he also understood what a monopoly was because the American Revolution had been fought in part to throw off these noxious monopolies. And Jefferson was very clear. The only reason we're going to allow this noxious legal device, a monopoly, is because right now these inventors are going to starve unless we have some mechanism, you know, that they can get some of the benefits. They didn't envision that corporations would own these patents, and there weren't transnational corporations at that time in the modern form. So Congress can, you know, enact legislation saying, oh, there's been a little confusion. We want to clarify living things are excluded. We don't expect that to happen in that simple form, especially without some social movement. But let me close. Now, this is a depressing point, but it just underlies the importance of it. Kristen talked about that famine is going to wipe out many of these crops. Now, I deal, I'm sometimes one of them, or I sit in the forums. I'm not involved in plant genetic engineering. Let me just say, at the highest levels of the agribusiness industry, they understand deeply that famines are going to hit these crops. They're counting on it, because the whole reason to get monopoly control of the food supply is to be able to drive prices, the price of food up, right, to get super profits off of food. What do you have to do? Well, historically, you have to create a shortage, right, in order to do that. And though, you know, there's no written evidence, and there never will be written evidence, but almost certainly these things are coupled. In the long run, you have corporate control over the food supply, right? You have monoculture at a world scale. You've driven out of production all the diverse varieties, and now a famine occurs. You don't have to let it loose. It will happen because of the fundamental problems in the design. And then there's a shortage. Suddenly there's a worldwide shortage of grain. Whoosh, right? Up goes the price of grain. The shortage is gotten rid of, and the price of grain doesn't come down. And you have all seen this in the 1973, the oil shortages that we've seen in many other things. So we're talking about, you know, profound transformations, but I actually don't believe that these corporations are going to be able to carry these plans out, because the resistance in all over the world, in the communities you'd least expect it, like Austria. Who would have expected a national referendum in Austria around genetic engineering. There's no history in the post-World War II period of public, of open public expression in that country. Anyway, I've overstepped my time. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak with you.
That was Jonathan King, a member of the Council for Responsible Genetics and a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He spoke last month at a biogenetics teach-in at the Learning Alliance in New York City. You're listening to Democracy Now! On Pacifica Radio. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Five Nobel laureates, including the Dalai Lama, Elie Wiesel, José Ramos Horta from East Timor, and Ireland's Betty Williams, gathered last night in New York City to announce the unveiling of a new initiative, an international code of conduct on arms transfers. The Commission of Nobel Peace Laureates, established by Costa Rica's Nobel Peace Prize winner, Dr. Oscar Arias, in 1995, has drawn up a model international code of conduct on arms transfers, which they hope will serve as the basis of an international agreement outlining strict criteria to govern global arms transfers. Last night at St. John the Divine Cathedral in New York City, Dr. Arias explained the new arms control initiative.
Today, I have the pleasure of being in the company of one extremely distinguished group of international leaders. We have come together on this occasion as humanitarians and as spokespeople of civil society to publicly unveil an international code of conduct on arms transfers that we have written. In addition to those present, the code has been fully endorsed by seven more Nobel Peace Laureates: Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Lech Walesa, Rigoberta Menchú, Adolfo Pérez Esquivel, Joseph Rotblat, May Reed Corrigan Maguire, and Norman Borlaug. Last week, we received a letter from President Jimmy Carter expressing his support for this code of conduct, saying it is, quote, a critically important step toward defining moral benchmarks which all countries in the world can and should strive to meet. And just yesterday, President Mikhail Gorbachev wrote to reaffirm his full support for the idea of limitation and strict international regulation of arms transfers. Although he raised serious concerns about the sections dealing with human rights and democracy, he said, "I am ready to continue cooperation with you, Mr. President, and with your commission. May I ask that at the press conference planned for May 29th, you announce that I support continuation of the work on the code within the framework of the United Nations and subject to my positions on Articles 3 to 5. At this time, my friends, I would like to read what we will sign in a few minutes. This is the statement that we will be signing in a few minutes. We come from different nations with varied histories. And in the past, the world has honored each of our struggles for peace and justice with the Nobel Peace Prize for Peace. Today, we speak as one voice We speak as one to voice our common concern regarding the destructive effects of the unregulated arms trade. Together, we have written an international code of conduct on arms transfers, which, once adopted by all arms-selling nations, will benefit all humanity, nationalities, ethnicities, and religions. This international code of conduct would govern all arms transfers, including conventional weapons and munitions, military and security training, and sensitive military and dual-use technologies. The code stipulates that any country wishing to purchase arms must meet certain criteria, including the promotion of democracy, the protection of human rights, and transparency in military spending. It would also prohibit arms sales to nations that support terrorism and to states that are engaged in aggression against other nations or peoples. The international community can no longer ignore the repercussions of irresponsible arms transfers. Indiscriminate weapons sales foster political instability and human rights violations, prolong violent conflicts, and weaken diplomatic efforts to resolve differences peacefully. Arms transfers often take place under a cloud of secrecy and generally respond to the desires of a few while ignoring the needs and rights of the many. Sadly, many governments continue to divert scarce resources toward arms purchases while their people live in abject poverty. Millions of civilians have been killed in conflict this century, and many more have lost their loved ones, their homes, their spirit. In a world where 1.3 billion people earn less than $1 a day, the sale of weapons simply perpetuates poverty. Our children urgently need schools and health centers, not machine guns and fighter planes. Our children also need to be protected from violence. The dictators of this world, not the poor, clamor for arms. Once in effect, this international code of conduct on arms transfers would prevent undemocratic governments from building sophisticated arsenals. Governments which systematically abuse internationally recognized human rights through practices such as torture or arbitrary executions would not receive military training. Countries who commit genocide would not be able to buy munitions. Governments engaged in armed aggression against other countries or peoples could not buy missiles. States that support terrorism would be prevented from acquiring weapons. In addition, all nations would be required to report their arms purchases to the United Nations. This code of conduct would undeniably promote global peace and security and protect human rights. We call on all nations to endorse this international code of conduct on arms transfers. The citizens of the world must demand that leaders support this code, as well as similar efforts on the national and regional level. Only through solidarity, compassion, and courageous leadership can we make violence and its vestiges a distant memory of the past. Friends, allow me to expand on why I convened this group of Nobel Peace laureates to write an international code of conduct on arms transfers. War and the preparation for war is one of the greatest obstacles to human progress. Violence does not resolve problems. Rather, it fosters a vicious cycle of arms buildups, conflict, and poverty. Yet, instead of addressing the root causes of conflict, many states often utilize military might in order to control increasingly desperate populations. Many developing countries continue to be burdened by high percentages of their population living in misery. Let us not forget the magnitude of the challenges that face us as we enter the 21st century. In today's world, nearly 1 billion people are illiterate. More than 1 billion lack access to potable water, and 1.3 billion earn less than $1 a day. Unfortunately, half of the world's governments dedicate more resources to defense expenditures than to health programs. Imagine what we could do if a portion of world military spending was redirected toward investing in human development. In 1995, world military spending totaled nearly $800 billion. If we redirected just $40 billion of those resources over the next 10 years to fighting poverty, all of the world's population would enjoy basic social services such as education, healthcare, and nutrition, reproductive health, clean water, and sanitation. Another $40 billion would provide all people on the planet with an income above the poverty line for the country. World leaders must make human security the priority for the 21st century. In contrast to the traditional concept of security linked to military capacity and economic power, human security represents the degree to which human beings are protected from ignorance, sickness, hunger, neglect, and persecution. Until the demands for human security are met, this cord will continue to boil in all regions of the world, periodically escalating into violent confrontations. History has recorded more devastating statement conflicts in the 20th century than ever before. While our technological capability to destroy has multiplied, our ability to empathize with the problems of the afflicted has minimized. Who can forget the massacres of millions in the Russian Revolution, the Holocaust, Japan, Cambodia, and Rwanda? As we approach the turn of the century, our coming future is threatened by regional conflicts and arms races that are raging around the world. The people of Somalia, Chechnya, and Pakistan can all attest to the fact that the end of the Cold War has not brought the political stability to all regions of the world. The people of East Timor and Tibet are acutely aware that not all peoples enjoy the right to self-determination. The fate of Aung San Suu Kyi, the 1991 Nobel Peace Laureate, and the supporters of her Democratic Party depicts how the military regime in Burma has responded to clamors for democracy by firing bullets. In these cases, and in many others, the indiscriminate international arms trade has empowered non-democratic governments, stifled independence movements, and intensified territorial conflicts. Since the end of the Cold War, many industrialized nations have reduced their defense budgets. Thus, those countries' arms merchants have turned to the developing world, where the majority of conflicts take place today, for new clients. In 1994, arms transfer to the developing world totaled $25.4 billion. Together, the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, France, the United States, China, Russia, and the United Kingdom, were responsible for over 90% of those arms transfers. Ironically, those entrusted with guaranteeing world security seek to ensure their own economic prosperity through the sale of weapons. In 1993, the United States was responsible for 73% of arms sales to the developing world. Even more incredibly, 90% of the U.S. arms customers that year were not democracies, and over two-thirds were characterized by the U.S. Department of State as human rights abusers. For many industrialized countries that manufacture arms, economic prosperity is seen as partially contingent upon a thriving military industry. Armament production is viewed by many as indispensable for technological development and as a vital source of employment. World leaders must accept the fact that we cannot let the free market rule the international arms trade. We must not enrich ourselves through the sale of death. When will the aerospace executives read the diaries written by those imprisoned, tortured, and maimed by military regimes? Only blindness, my friends, could hide from us the fact that the arms trade is a friend of dictators and an enemy of the people. The time has come to make people more important than arms. For these reasons, in 1995, I proposed to my fellow Nobel Peace Laureates that we join together to write an international code of conduct on arms transfers. Some might question the close relationship to the supply and demand concept of a free market. If a country's leaders want arms, some might ask, who are we to say that they shouldn't have them? That question merits two responses. First, as I stated above, the arms manufacturers have been aggressively promoting sales to the developing world in order to make up for the drastic reduction in arms procurement by most industrialized countries since the end of the Cold War. Furthermore, when one asserts that a country wants arms, to whom exactly are we referring? Is it the single mother in Indonesia or the orphan who lives on the street in Egypt who are pressuring their leaders to buy tanks and missiles? Or is it a dictator such as President Mobutu of Zaire who sees arms purchases as the only way to maintain power? The poor of the world are crying out for schools and doctors, not guns and generals. Another another argument posited to justify the sale of arms is that if one country does not sell arms to a nation that wishes to buy them, someone else will. That is precisely why all arms-selling nations must agree to certain restrictions. Only a comprehensive international effort to monitor and regulate arms transfers will be effective. We can no longer say business is business and turn a blind eye on the poverty and oppression caused by arms transfers. Just like slavery and the drug trade, the arms trade reaps profits from the commerce of death. To make this code of conduct a reality may take some time, but humanity, my friends, cannot wait. The poor and the forsaken cannot wait. There is no time to delay. We know that with a fraction of the resources now dedicated to weapon procurement, it will be possible to resolve the most serious problems of health, education, hunger, and housing, which afflict the world and within a reasonable time period. We must use our wisdom to form an alliance of global citizens against the arms trade. Our sword will be our determination and will. Our shield will be our solidarity. Let us win this struggle to regulate arms transfers, for if we are not its victors, we will certainly be its victims.
Dr. Oscar Arias, Nobel Peace Prize winner from Costa Rica, standing with fellow and sister Peace Prize winners as they announced a model international code of conduct on arms transfers, which they hope will serve as the basis of an international agreement outlining strict criteria to govern global arms transfers. He was speaking last night at St. John the Divine Cathedral in New York City. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with help from Lauren Comito. Errol Maitland is our assistant producer and New York engineer. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!